Yes. Anyway, at one point, they were stolen. And it was a great tragedy for the whole town that the hosts were stolen, and how could that happen? And so the way they tell the story is that everybody in the town prayed, and the power of their prayer brought them back one way or another. The details of the story are unimportant. Swami's response was, there must have been one saint praying. He said, even all the prayers of average people would not generate a miracle. There would have to be one force that really could bring that power in. Because a lot of people on a certain level just make a lot more energy on that level. They don't collectively suddenly make the power of a saint. It's a very simple statement about the way it works. And so we look at Ananda and Swamiji's, what I was going to say with that is that his thought, because of what happened to him in SRF, and that's why the whole story of Ananda is all about SRF. Here he was, this person who had so much to give to Master, and the other chapter that we read tonight is how come the Delhi Project didn't work, but Ananda did. I was the same, but in Ananda, there was nobody stopping me, and I was allowed to do it. So Swamiji's thought about Ananda was, I certainly don't want to be the one who's stopping anybody. And he had to really put his mind to it. Now, it was very natural for him. He put his mind to it, and he understood it very simply. But he had to really put his mind to it. How do I balance this? Because a free-for-all is going to accomplish nothing. He describes in there a little bit of the early days at the farm and old Blue and how it took 5 years to make the decision about the dog. And I was talking to Jyotish about those days too just recently. And he said in the first year or two, 69 and 70, said they just didn't have these meetings really often. And people just loved the meetings. They'd all come together. And he said there'd be a lot of talk, a lot of processing, and not a lot of decisions, just day after day after day. And then he named a few names of people who would bring up the same issues. This woman named Leilani, whom I remember. Leilani had a dog named Ginger. I remember Leilani. I remember Ginger. Ginger had a bad temper. She would snap at the children. So they would bring it up that maybe something should be done about Ginger. And then Leilani would say, oh, you don't love me. Nobody has ever loved me in my life. And then everyone would say, oh, we love you, Leilani. And we just do that, Jyoti said, week after week. And then Ginger would keep snapping at the children, and then they'd all start over again. You know? I mean, it was the early 70s. It was that time, and that's sort of what people did. But nothing could ever happen from that. And even at the same time, you get people with real magnetism and real energy. But how do you keep them all going in the same direction? People can be very sincere, but utterly misguided. I mean, I would certainly put myself in that category. I was so energetic and so enthusiastic and so dumb so much of the time. I just made so many wrong decisions. And yet, I wanted to make right decisions, and I was really a go-getter. I was on the team. But to have given me too much freedom would have been a disaster. But not to have given me the illusion of freedom would also have been a disaster. And just it's just so perfect what he set up. And he comments later, I don't know if it's here, I've been reading too much, so my sources are all mixed up in my mind. But when Swamiji started writing about leadership, he was writing a paper called Involved Management. I don't know if he ever, did he ever finish that? He started writing a paper called Involved Management, which was he was trying to find a way to describe how Ananda works. Involved meaning that the people most involved are the ones who are the managers of situations, not as a dogma, but as a practice. And he said he had always followed the common thought at SRF that Master was not into organizing, or even that Master was not good at organizing, because there was no visible structure at Mount Washington. And as Swamiji himself says, the monks were never organized until Swami got there. And then the nuns organized themselves on the model that Swami set up for the monks. So there was nothing. And Master just ran it. But as Swami got more deeply into it, trying to write this paper, it just came to Swami, and he couldn't believe he'd never really seen it before, that Master had the place superbly organized. But he organized it entirely by magnetism. And not just by the loyalty that individuals showed to him, which they did, but by projecting such a clear thought that people, when they tried to understand what they should do, they would find that thought. And then the thought would come from them, And it would resonate with their own reality. But what you have to appreciate is we're always influenced by something. Swamiji, in the early years of Ananda, he was so insistent. He had to fight a battle to get people to sing the songs that he had written in the beginning.
Yeah?
Yeah? I mean, the things that... Yeah, because... See, all these things were given now, but he had written those songs. He's very self-effacing. He never said, you know, this is the right music. This is going to be the saving of Ananda. This was Swamiji's music. So Swami writes his songs, and then X, Y, and Z say, and I write mine. He expresses himself, and then I express myself. But Swamiji's objection, primarily, as he put it, were the songs that most people wrote. He said were imitative. John Denver was very popular at that time, and he said they're just bad copies of John Denver's songs. They're not really original songs at all. They're being influenced, but they're just being influenced from somewhere else. And what Swamiji said, and those who followed it found it to be true, if you get in tune with this music, you will be able to be original. Because this music will put you in tune with yourself. And so people saw it as a coercive thing, and as Swami used to say, it's a bit awkward because I did write it, he said. But I don't consider it my music, it's just the right music. That's how he said it. It's not my music, it's just the right music for Ananda. And people who really got in tune with that vibration became in tune because that was where the energy came from. They took that as their influence. So there's this mistake that people have that you can live without being influenced. Of course you're going to be influenced. You're just either going to reflect what the world going on around you or something inside of you. In Swami's The Seven Points of an Ananda Sanghi, The Way of an Ananda Sanghi, which is coming out in the next newsletter, this statement that Swami made, he said one of those points is that we live from our own inspiration and not in reaction to the world around us. That's a very simple statement, but it's very true. And so the first thing you have to do, what you want to be responding to, is you want to be responding to the Guru's vibration within you. You want to be living in that ray. Your thoughts are universal, they're not individual. That's what Master says in the AY. Thoughts are universal. So which universal thoughts do you want to pick up on? Do you want to pick up on the ones projected from Master through Swamiji, having sent Swami to us, or do you want to just pick them up from who knows where else? Who else is projecting thoughts at us? It was an interesting dynamic. I think I'll take a break before I go on because I want to go in a whole other way with it. Okay, let's take 10 minutes. There were several things that I just wanted to finish that are sort of about this history period of Ananda. It's where I started, but I never got back to it. Let me just stay here. The hidden influence of antagonism, which has sort of been a theme with Ananda, which I know nowadays, the more you talk, when I talk about it now, it seems ludicrous. It's almost like Swamiji has crossed over into some kind of a dimension. This is where I was starting to say that SRF had so much power for so long, and Swamiji was so restrained in his relationship to them that they maintained that power. They were just the authority on Master's work. And we never believed it. I mean, I said this on another video that we had. I said, we just took Swami as we found him. His legitimacy as a disciple was just self-evident to us. We didn't need persuading. But what happened was the group of people who have opposed Ananda have been essentially the same group for all of these years. There's this small coterie of people who were part of Ananda in the early years. I mean, they add a few to their numbers, like Anne-Marie Bertolucci was recruited more recently. But the support that she got was from this crowd of people who'd been part of Ananda in the early 70s and in through the 70s. And they were just folk who came during this time when Swamiji was being so understated in every external way about his position. And I was trying to figure out how there's a man named Jim Barnhart who doesn't loom large in any of your realities. He looms larger in my mental sky because I have a personal connection with him. Eric Estep is a name that you might know more, those of you who are involved with different things. But and there's other names. They lived at Ananda in the 70s. Eric lived a little longer into the 80s, I think. And they just never got what was going on with Swami ever. They just didn't see him as a channel, what to speak of the channel of Master's consciousness for those of us who chose to affiliate with that environment. They lived in that environment and thought it was a wide open choice. And then I asked myself, but why did they persevere for so long in their antagonism to him? And even Dayamata and Anandamata and the others, why did they persevere for so long? I mean, there's many explanations. Swamiji wrote a letter at one point trying to answer that question about people like Eric and Jim Barnhart and a few others. Swami wrote it this way. He said, there are people who come to Ananda who have an experience there, and then for one reason or another, it's not where they want to stay, and they just move on. He said, there are others for whom the experience has made such a profound impression that they can never leave it behind. They can never reconcile, as well Swami put it, they can never reconcile their failure. That the demands of the experience of being in Ananda were not small, and it wasn't about living in teepees and not having any money. I mean, that aspect of it was very simple. It was the demand created by the vibration of consciousness that Swami was putting out. It was similar, although Swamiji said it was a piece of cake compared to what it was really like to live with Master. Swami just said, you have no idea what the vibration was like to live with Master. And it was just the demand of Master's consciousness demanded a corresponding wakefulness. And Swami writes, I think in here he writes, about just every once in a while he would just think, can't I just go read a book? Can't I just stop having to be so wide awake and so in tune all the time? And I love how Swami describes how he, one day he felt so rebellious when he lived in Mount Washington, he lay on the bed and read Shakespeare. Wow. You know, on my best day I'll lie on the bed and read Shakespeare, not on my big rebellion day, right? But it just sort of gives you an idea of what was being asked of them at all times. And what it was vibrational. It was that Master was just vibrating with a certain level of consciousness, and when you were close to him you needed to meet it. And when you didn't meet it, you felt very dissonant. You couldn't just ignore it because it was too powerful. My personal experience of when I first came to Ananda Village and had the opportunity to be with Swami, which I always just loved being with Swami, is because I had to be awake when I was with him, and I liked being awake. I was a person, you know, I never took very many drugs, I never drank very much, because I didn't like being put to sleep. I liked being awake, and I just didn't like what happened when my faculties were dulled. It was not a pleasure to me. And with Swamiji, you had to be really awake, because you just never knew what he was going to say. And he never said anything. You could never predict what he would say. It was always so interesting. And you needed to be able to respond. You had to be there. But even more than that, there was just a vibration of wakefulness, just the sheer energy with which he approached life. And that was what I was seeking. And so I loved being around that environment. And it was just all through Ananda. It was through Ananda in the sense of just the demands placed upon us. And it was a little bit of the physical, but I never considered that difficult. I was a healthy, energetic young person. That wasn't a problem. But we would walk from Ayodhya to the farm. We lived at Ayodhya, where Swami lives now, and we worked at the farm, we called it then, which is the community now, in what is now Hansa Temple, but used to be the publications building. And it was a distance of a little more than a mile up and down a steep hill, very steep up, down, the same distance, and you have to go up and down. In rain, shine, snow, or sleet, we did not have a car, we just walked. So it would be, you know, over 100 degrees in the summer, and you just walk through the blistering sun up and down the hill. And then in the blizzard, you'd have to walk. In the pouring rain, you'd have to walk. There was just no other way to get there. And in the winter, you had, you know, bean boots, the felt-lined boots, and you had a complete wetsuit, rain suit, and you just bundled up and just crashed through. Sometimes you'd come home in the dark, in the blizzard. It just never seemed hard to me. But there were many other levels which you just weren't able to be crabby, to blame others, to be resentful, to be self-justifying. I mean, you could try, but it didn't get you very far. It just got you really out of sorts with the whole reality of what was happening there, because there was this, I used to call it I used to call it the magnetic honesty of Ananda. There was a magnetic honesty. It was just the magnetism of the place just held truth. And I appreciate, even more than I knew at the time, the extent to which that was just Swami's consciousness. I mean, I knew it was about him, but I didn't realize how much it was about him, if I can say such a thing. Him being the magnet that drew Master's consciousness into the atmosphere. And it was, of course, our sincerity pulled it through Swami, but it was Swami's power that pulled it in the first place. If Swami hadn't been there, it just simply could not have happened on that level. There wasn't, you know, there wasn't anybody else who had a prayer of a chance of holding all that different energy together and moving it forward. It was mysterious the way it would happen. I used to describe it like Pigpen. You know Pigpen in Peanuts? How they always depict him and he's standing there and there's just all this dust swirling around him. Well, Ananda was so chaotic on a certain level. And yet, it was like this entity that just swirled in chaos, but the entire entity moved forward. There was this gentleman named Michael Meyerhofer, who was an Austrian attorney. Now, there is a very exact person, and Michael was a paragon of an Austrian attorney. He was a perfect example of an Austrian attorney. He came and spent about a year. He tried as hard as he could to understand how it worked, and he could not understand how it worked. But he had to admit that it did work. He just couldn't figure out how you could have no rules, no systems, you know, no organization to speak of, no hierarchy, no nothing, and yet the whole thing went forward because of Swami's magnetism. But in those early years, for his own reasons, he really did not want there to be anything that even slightly resembled a personality cult growing up around him. I think he was very, very wary of it because of SRF, and he also was because of SRF's perception of it, and he also was aware of the fact that once something like that starts, intuition, people start assuming attitudes because it's the understood attitude to have, and he never wanted there to be. He describes it in here. What does he call it? Well, but the institutional attitudes. He uses another phrase. He talks about that where Glenn spoke to him about he could always recognize an Ananda person. And Swami said he'd worked so hard to avoid there having been this defined way to be if you were part of Ananda. He talked about the SRF attitude, you know, of being serious by being too solemn. And he just never wanted Ananda to have a picture like that. And part of it was, in order to do that, was never to create a personality cult around himself. So you would be at Ananda for a long time and you would not really understand. You would have to feel it. No one would ever tell you the extent to which Swami was in charge. And I actually remember this exchange I had. I think it was with Parvati. Parvati had been there 6 months, maybe a year. And she came up to me and she said, "Everything emanates from Swamiji, doesn't it?" She said, "From that house over at Ayodhya, he's running it all, isn't he?" And I said, "Shh, don't tell anyone." I mean, that defined what the reality of it was. Now, why would I say don't tell anyone? Isn't that strange? But that is exactly what I said to her. And she also said it to me like, "I've uncovered something. Am I crazy or is this true?" Now, doesn't that seem like an odd thing? But it was like God himself wanted it. It was the early time, and it really needed to be people who had a lot of inner strength, because it had to be people who were really going to be able to just bring that thing into manifestation without. And a lot of the people who are, you know, leaders of Ananda all over all came in those very early years. We talk about that sometimes. There was just that core group of people: Anandi, Parvati, Padma, Arati, others. Just it was a really strong group. And we just had to know it without anybody telling us. And we had to keep it a secret so that nobody else would know it. They have to discover it for themselves too. That you would actually feel the magnetism, recognize what that magnetism meant, choose to tune into it without ever bringing it out into a conversation. Now, that didn't mean that people didn't admire Swami and recognize Swami. And many, many, many people were very devoted to him. But that devotion had to be hard won. It wasn't applied from the outside. And again, Swami did everything he could, I think even just psychically, to keep the thought at bay. And even when, as recently as when the Bertolucci lawsuit happened, which was 1994, and there was a lot of cracking within Ananda of people not, it wasn't, the problem with that lawsuit was not that Swami was accused of not being perfectly celibate during the time he wasn't a celibate, which was the irony of the whole thing. He was accused of being a brutal, abusive man. That was the accusation. And there were people who actually had to stop and wonder whether he was or not. And Swami's response was just to go to Hawaii. He just said, you figure it out. And then he came back and he said,